voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices.
Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sunny Young in Washington. Welcome to the December 1st edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Let's kick off in Cairo, where Al Ahly recently defeated Zamalek 2-1 in an all-Egyptian CAF Champions League football final. It was a record-extending ninth Champions League trophy for Al Ahly. For reaction, Iron Mike Mbonye called Cairo, where he reached African football analyst Mohamed El Badri.
Yes, of course, Ahly and Zamalek played the final of the CAF Champions League. This is a plus for the Egyptian football. For the first time in the history of this competition, to have two clubs from the same country playing the final, that was huge. I think if you were in Egypt during that time, the tension in the air was very high because both teams were very excited. Fans of both teams were very excited. Everybody is afraid to lose. It's going to be humiliation for the losing side, maybe for the next couple of years or something. We call this game the game of the century. That was what was it called in Egypt, the game of the century. So I think the Egyptian football has put a hard footprint from this game. And I think also that people now in Africa are looking highly on the Egyptian league and Egyptian teams to be able to reach that game in this tough competition. I think that's something marvelous for the Egyptian football.
What's the secret behind the dominance of North African clubs in the continent?
Various reasons, actually. First of all, most of the players in North Africa do not go to play abroad like in West of Africa, for example. If we took the players from Cameroon, from Cote d'Ivoire, from Nigeria, from Sierra Leone, Togo, Ghana, all the West, most of the younger players, Senegal as well, most of the younger players go to play abroad at a very young age. When we look at the North Africa, and particularly in Egypt, our players get paid very well at home. So most of them do not prefer to go abroad unless they have a very huge contracts and a big bonuses and to the big leagues and big clubs, but they don't really go to small leagues or just to go abroad to play. That's one of the reasons why the North African clubs are dominant, because most of their good players are playing at these clubs. The other thing is North African clubs also pay very good salaries in comparison to the rest of Africa. The third reason is the mentality of North African teams is a bit different than the mentality of the rest of the continent. They have a winning mentality, and that is something we see always, even on the competition level of national teams. When you see teams from Morocco or Egypt or Tunisia, their winning mentality makes them wins most of the games, although they might not have the best squad, as we've seen the Nigerian squad or Ghanaian squad. If you count the number of times that North African teams, national teams, won the AFCON, it will exceed those in West Africa or South Africa, and of course in East Africa.
What's your assessment of Al Ahly coach Pitso Mosimane? Do you see him winning more trophies with the club?
I think he will enjoy being at Al Ahly, and I think he will be in Al Ahly for a long time. Al Ahly in general is a very strong team, and the mentality of the Al Ahly as both administration and also as players is a very aggressive winning mentality. Let me give you a quick number. Most of the coaches who come to train Al Ahly, who had average of 1.4 to 1.6 points per game, when they managed Al Ahly, they went up to 2.2 to 2.4 points per game. That is the Al Ahly effect. So even with the mid-level coaches, when they come and train Al Ahly, they become top-class coaches. And I think with Pitso Mosimane, who is one of the very good coaches, one of the best coaches in the continent, he will be able to do a lot of things with Al Ahly, and I think they will win many more more trophies. I'm very excited to see them playing the Club World Cup and see how their performance will be. I think the last game of Mosimane against Zamalek in the final of Champions League was one of his worst games, one of the best games. However, he managed to win. That's because of the mentality of the players. But in the coming games, I think next season, things will be a lot different. He will have enough time to build the team the way he wants them to play. So we will see a modified version of Sundowns, because Al Ahly as a club and as a team is much better than the counterpart in South Africa, the Sundowns.
That's African football analyst Mohamed El Badri. And he spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Cairo, Egypt.
This is Mohamed El Badri. I am the co-founder and CEO of CoraStats, a data service company that is working with many of the clubs in Egypt, providing them with performance analysis data about their teams and opponents. You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Now let's go to Accra, where Kwabena Quicksilver Ofori has an update for us on the performance of a couple of Ghanaian football clubs in the main CAF competitions.
Ghana's two representatives in this year's CAF Inter-Club competitions, Kumasi Asante Kotoko and Ashanti Gold, registered draws in their first leg matches at the weekend. Asante Kotoko in their CAF Champions League preliminary game against Mauritanian side FC Nouadhibou resulted in a 1-1 draw in Mauritania, while host Ashanti Gold drew goalless with their Burkinabe visitors, Salitas, in the CAF Confederation Cup at the Obuasi Lenclet Stadium. Ashanti Gold could not utilize their home advantage as they blew a lot of scoring chances playing behind closed doors, per the COVID-19 restriction could be a disadvantage. But it is up to the Golden Boys to focus and win the second leg in Ouagadougou this Saturday. The winners after the two legs will face El Ahmar of Sudan or FC Zanzibar in the next stage of the championship. In the CAF Champions League preliminary, Asante Kotoko got an early unquestionable opener in the fifth minute, but host FC Nouadhibou of Mauritania got their needed equalizer through a penalty. The Mauritanians will travel to Ghana for the return leg on Sunday, December 6th. And the winners will progress to the next round of the competition to meet Al Hilal Club of Sudan or Ugandan Club Vipers. For the sunny side of sports, Kwabena Ofori in Accra.
Thanks, Kwabena. It's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Sporty greetings, Nnamdi.
Sporty greetings, Sunny.
Nnamdi, I know in the past you've used the phrase a rangy fight. That is a fight where the result is fixed before the fighters even get into the ring. Was the recent draw between former world heavyweight champions Mike Tyson and Roy Jones Jr. an arrangy fight?
Yes, indeed. A arrangy fight in my backyard, Staples Center, right here in Los Angeles, City of Angels. It was a great fight. It was a fight that lots of fight fans been looking forward to, and it lived up to expectation. It was not just a fight, but the entertainment part of the fight. We had performance by superstars from the hip-hop and the rap world, from Snoop Doggy Dogg, French Montana, Wiz Khalifa. So that brought that whole Hollywood LA vibe to it, and the whole card was fun. And Iron Mike and Roy Jones did their thing. The undercard was another story, and it was beautiful. An African opened the telecast with a very, very good performance. And man, it was worth the money.
In terms of the money, Nnamdi, break down what Iron Mike and Roy Jones Jr. were paid, as well as the pay-per-view numbers.
Sonny, Iron Mike was guaranteed $10 million before he stepped into the ring. Roy Jones was guaranteed $1 million and $3 million after the fight. You also have to understand, this is just on the front side. On the back end, since this was a pay-per-view event, they get a piece of the action when we get the final pay-per-view numbers. Remind you also, here in America, we paid $50 a pop to see the fight. The pre-sale projection was off the chain, was huge. The pre-sales was bigger than any number we've seen in boxing or MMA. The projection we're looking at for this big fight is anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 million buys in the U.S. alone. This fight was streamed to 36 countries around the globe. Mind you, Iron Mike Tyson is a true global superstar. And this fight happening in a time where we didn't really have anything to entertain us. I mean, the fights we were seeing or the fights were shown on the TV just had no Machiavelli, had no elite performer to really make us get up and buy. So lots of people spent that $50 because there was no way for fans to go in, so there was no boxing fans. I paid $50 and I enjoyed watching it.
Namdi, some boxing fans say Iron Mike Tyson dominated the fight and looked to be in better shape than Roy Jones Jr. Your thoughts?
Iron Mike was in better shape than Roy Jones, really, to think about it. Remember, this is a man that dropped 100 pounds getting ready for this fight. And all the videos he was posting before the fight showed that he still has the hand speed and he still has the power. Iron Mike was not really at any point in trouble. The scoring, well, Sonny, you also have to understand it was an exhibition. And in exhibitions, there are no winners or losers. California State Athletic Commission made it clear before the fight, nobody forced the knockout. And if you do force the knockout, you will not be paid. So that's why Iron Mike did not go in there trying to destroy Roy Jones or make it a crazy fight like everybody was expecting him. And the fight ended in what we call a split draw, and everybody was a winner. And also remember, WBC created a belt for this event called the Frontline Belt. And WBC brought two belts to the arena the night of the fight. So at the end of the fight, WBC presented Iron Mike and Roy Jones the same belt. And hey, this is where the RNG comes again.
Namdi, what's next for 54-year-old Mike Tyson? Do you think he'll fight again?
What will Iron Mike do? Iron Mike said this is the first exhibition. And the names we're looking at, a rematch with Roy Jones or a fight with Evander Holyfield. Remember the ear-biting incident when both fought for the first time? So a rematch with Holyfield and Iron Mike will even be bigger than Iron Mike and Roy Jones. Then we have Shannon Briggs, and he said he wants to take on winner of Tyson Fury and Tony Joshua for an exhibition. And all this can happen because Iron Mike is a global draw and he brings the money to the table. How will these other fighters react if it's held in Japan or the UK and the boxing commission is not as strong? We don't know. So in the meantime, it could be Evander Holyfield, which makes more sense. A rematch with Roy Jones will not sell.
Namdi, on the undercard of the Roy Jones Mike Tyson exhibition bout, former NBA player Nate Robinson knocked out by Jake Paul. Your reaction?
Sonny, the undercard was very entertaining also. Here we have a YouTube star and social media influencer in Jake Paul taking on former NBA three-time slam dunk champion in Nate Robinson. And not only that, this guy played in the NBA for 11 years, Sonny. Oh, man, the question you ask, Sonny, how did an NBA former elite in the NBA end up fighting and a YouTube star? It was a very bad, terrible fight. He was knocked out in the second round, you know, and he was not just knocked out, he was knocked out cold. He was on the floor, face down for like 2 to 3 minutes before they had to bring in his tool to get him to sit up. Celebrity boxing is really, it's really something we have to be careful with because this could have ended in a situation where Nate Robinson will end up in the hospital with a brain injury. I mean, he was really slammed, you know. He was really banged up. Jake Paul, this is his second fight. He's a big draw. It's all about eyeballs. He has 32 million followers on YouTube. So when they put this fight together and they put him on the card fighting a nobody, all his followers will tune in. And that's a big plus for the promotion. And when we do a promotion like this, it's all about eyeballs and who will buy and who are the stars. So celebrity boxing and the real boxing, it's not a bad deal, but the matchmaking must be improved.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta. And we'll hear more hard-hitting boxing commentary from Namdi later this week. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. The energetic Andy Edwards is talking this week with Charlie Spedding, Britain's 1984 Olympic bronze medalist in the men's marathon and the author of From Last to First. In the second part of their conversation, Andy begins by remembering Charlie's two marathon victories in 1984 before the Los Angeles Olympic Games.
You'd won two marathons before that. You did win Houston, your debut in January, and then you qualified for the British team by winning London, and you've beaten the likes of Yume Kanga, who was a very fine runner from Tanzania. And there's a line in the book which I think is fascinating for those of us who might feel sometimes non-African runners get intimidated these days. You just say, well, I saw Ikanga in that group, and I knew I'd beaten him before. And it doesn't sound arrogant, but it was just a fact.
It's entirely matter of fact. It's how you have to think in a competition. You're all just out there doing your best, and you're up against people you know they're very good. But you take whatever positives you can. And if, you know, as I'd beaten him before, it made sense for me to tell myself, I can beat him, I know I can, because I've done it before. And that's very important, because you've got to maintain a high level of self-confidence, which isn't arrogance at all. It's essential to believe that you're going to do well, or else you won't do well.
You go through half marathon, this group, in about, I think, 65 minutes. I mean, it's still quite a large group. And then how does the race develop in the second half?
It continues to go along at a very good pace without being crazily fast, but it's a good solid pace. I knew I was running close to my personal best, but my fitness and training had told me that I could certainly do that. It's a good pace without being crazy, and it went on and on, and I'd always expected people to start making moves to try and win it, and the further we went, that didn't happen. The group was still there, and it was still this top class group, but we're all running together, and we went past 20 miles. And we were all still together. And I'd expected someone like the world champion, Rob Di Castella, to make a long run from home, really, really push hard. And I was kind of waiting for him to do that. And in my mental preparation before the race, I'd visualize it. And when he makes his move, I'm gonna cling to his back for as far as I can. And we went past 21 miles, 22 miles, and it didn't happen. But I'd always known that a long run for home was my best chance, because there were people there who could finish more quickly than me in the very final stages. And I realized that no one was going to do it. And I had the most extraordinary thought at around about 22 miles that here I was, little old me, at 22 miles in the Olympic marathon. And I was thinking, the pace isn't fast enough. I need to pick it up. And I thought I had visualized every situation that could happen, and that had absolutely never crossed my mind. So I had to spend a minute or two just gearing myself mentally to do that and go to the front. And I didn't go crazy. I just moved past Ikanga and gradually picked the pace up by about 10 seconds per mile and put everyone, including myself, under quite a bit of pressure. But I knew this was my best chance, and I had to do it. And I have to say that once I'd done it and I got to the front, even though it was physically hard, mentally, it was absolutely wonderful. That here I was leading the Olympic marathon, putting the best runners in the world under pressure. I wasn't convincing myself I was beating them, but I knew I was putting them under pressure because they weren't running on my shoulder. They were just behind me, but I was making them work, and it was wonderful.
There's a lot more of the story before we get to the end, but at the end of the book, the last paragraph or two paragraphs, you talk about, of course, once you got an Olympic medal, people want you to address running seminars, clubs, and you become a kind of, in the distance running world in Britain, a kind of celebrity. And people ask you for what's the greatest moment of your career, and they assume it's going to be crossing the line in the stadium, and then it's you at that moment in the race. And whether that line you write comes in there, but another line that sticks in my mind is, here I am, a 32-year-old chemist, that is pharmacist, from County Durham, and I'm leading the Olympic marathon. I mean, it comes back to the original thing of, how does an ordinary person, supposedly ordinary, win a medal? But that remained, and you had quite a lot of running and races to come after Los Angeles, that remained the absolute pinnacle for you.
Yes, yes, absolutely. When people ask me what was the best moment, it was leading, then trying to win the Olympic marathon. Obviously, crossing the line and winning a medal was also absolutely fabulous and huge. But the best moment for me was doing it. And I think that comes back to what people get from sport at whatever level they are. It's doing it, performing to your best. Whatever your best is, performing like that is the crucial thing about sport.
I agree entirely that, in a way, everybody, mass runners or whatever your sport is, can relate to that. However, still in the race, it emerges that it's really three men: you, Carlos Lopez, the Portuguese, as you mentioned earlier, who won the World Cross Country title in New York in March of that year and would go on to win it again on home ground the next year. And as you say, John Tracy, very tough Irish guy, good over cross country track and road, and really kind of the epitome, you might say, old school, tough distance runner. They now emerged, well, the three of you emerged as the contenders for medals, but what colour? So how did it then develop?
Well, after I'd led for a while, I realised that there were people still with me, and I was getting very tired and starting to think, well, I don't know if I can keep this pressure up all the way. So I thought, well, I'll let someone else lead for a moment. I tucked in behind Tracy and Lopez, and shortly afterwards, Lopez decided to really go for it, and he picked up the pace considerably. I tried to go with him, and I was on the edge of sprinting to try to stay with him, and I knew I had to let him go. And John Tracy had been slightly behind me, but he came alongside me, and we ran. And Lopez went away for the medal in a new Olympic record, and John Tracy and I ran side by side for the last 3 miles, and very, very tough last 3 miles. That hurt, but it doesn't matter. Yes, it does hurt, but it doesn't really matter when you are achieving what you're achieving at that moment. But it was tough, and I had to keep concentrating and keep holding ourselves together. And then when we got very close to the stadium, we were a long way in front of the guy behind, but we didn't realise how far it was. We got close to the stadium. I was thinking about how I might try to beat him inside on the track. And when I was thinking that, he surged. And I wasn't concentrating on him. I was thinking about what I was going to do. And he got a bit of a few yards gap on me. And I knew just before we took a turn down and ran underneath the stadium and out onto the track. And I thought, well, I have to catch him before we get on the track, or I'll never beat him. So I put in really what was my last effort. And I caught him on the track, and there was a lap and a quarter to run once he got into the stadium, and I was behind him, hanging on, and in a stadium full of 80,000 people that I didn't really notice because I was focused so much on John Tracy's back. And down the back straight, he was able to pick it up again, and I kept going at the same speed, but I had nothing more, and he got a few yards away from me. And I finished a very, very tired third, and absolutely ecstatic was my performance.
That's Charlie Spedding, Britain's 1984 Olympic bronze medalist in the men's marathon and the author of From Last to First. And we'll hear more of Charlie's conversation with the energetic Andy Edwards later this week.
I'm Kendra Harrison. I'm the 100 hurdle world record holder for Team USA, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
In auto racing news, Formula One driver Romain Grosjean is in recovery after escaping a fiery crash in the opening lap of the F1 Bahrain Grand Prix on Sunday. VOA's Gwen Uten has an update and reaction from the two Formula One doctors who helped save his life. Hey there, Gwen.
Hey there, Sonny. Romain Grosjean spoke from his hospital bed on Sunday to reassure fans that he was doing okay. The Frenchman miraculously walked away from the horrifying high-speed crash and subsequent explosion earlier that day with no broken bones and only burns on his hands and ankles. He's set to be discharged on Tuesday. Formula One doctor Ian Roberts witnessed the crash that happened within seconds of the start. And in an interview with Reuters TV, he described it as something straight out of a Hollywood movie.
Came around into turn three to be met by this fireball, which we both described as more like a Hollywood type of setup. And in fact, I could see Rama in his car attempting to get out. The fire was well going, and I could see him behind essentially a sheet of flame, almost furnace-like. And then it was straight out of the car and into do our best.
Roberts, along with South African Formula One medical driver Alan Vandermava, are being hailed for their swift action in rescuing Grosjean from his car that was ripped in half before it burst into flames. But despite the intensity of the heat, Roberts knew he had to work quickly to get Grosjean out.
The marshal whose extinguisher we used had crossed the track, as Romain was coming out of the cockpit, the extinguisher was focused on him. The flame was briefly pushed back, and as Romain appeared at the top of the barrier, that was our opportunity to really get in and grab hold of him. The fire was pretty intense, it was stinging my face. I couldn't feel anything anywhere else, but it was stinging my face, and knowing what Romain was climbing out of, the guy did a fantastic job of extricating himself.
Besides human feats of heroism, the Halo cockpit protection device is being credited as a major factor in saving Grosjean's life. The three-point titanium safety device sits above the front of the cockpit to protect drivers' heads from large pieces of flying debris. And while the Halo initially attracted controversy when it was introduced in 2018, Alan Vandermava credits the device for preventing an outcome that could have been much, much worse.
And I just remember being incredibly surprised how Romain's, the survival cell, had not actually traveled that far. It had hit the barrier and maybe traveled a meter and a half, and that's all it seemed to do. So the impact and the velocities involved made me think that actually this was potentially something that we were not going to be able to deal with very well. But the whole thing just unfolded really, really quickly and a very positive outcome.
Ironically, Grosjean, who once called the halo unnecessary, says without it, he would not have survived the crash. And I have to mention Lewis Hamilton was the winner in Sunday's Bahrain Grand Prix. After the race, he said it was tough to stay in the zone after Grosjean's crash, but he too is thankful the halo saved his life. And we here at the Sunny Side of Sports wish Romain Grosjean a very speedy recovery. And that is all from me, Sonny. Back over to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uden. And that wraps up the December 1st edition of the show. Thank you